This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Place to Be Nation, welcome to the epicenter of Southern wrestling, JT Allen. This is Letters from Center Stage Theater.
As the biggest night in the history of this great organization.
You are gonna feel the bad!
Place to Be Nation, welcome to episode number 5 of Letters from Kayfabe. I am JT Rosero. Here with me, as always, is the chap called Alan. Alan, how are you?
I am fantastic. I've been looking forward to recording this show. We've got some really good questions this week. I want to just thank everyone for supporting the show. The last 4 episodes have gone down a treat with most people. We've had some fantastic feedback. So thank you to everyone that's listened, plugged the show, told the friends. We really appreciate people that do that. Just tell a friend. Just say if you like, you know, WCW and kind of the wacky stuff that went on. You may have a friend that likes it too. So just spread the word. We'd really appreciate it.
We sure would. And of course, yes, here on Letters from Center Stage, we are in our offices in Atlanta, Georgia, and we're diving deep into the outer rim of the nostalgia mothership that was WCW, as you said, Alan. So why don't we waste no time? Why don't we reach deep, deep into that plunder bucket and get to our first mailbag question?
Hi, I'm Missy Hyatt, and welcome to Missy Does the Mail. This week's letter comes from Nikki Davis of Long Beach, California, who wants to know what I think of the new U.S. heavyweight champion.
Okay, into the plunder bucket we go, and here we are. Here we go. We've got Dear Alan and JT. What happened to the Honky Tonk Man at Starcade 1994? I remember his music playing, and then all of a sudden, Arn Anderson comes out to take his place, and that's thanks from Chris in St. Louis. So Honky Tonk Man, very short run in WCW, the back end of 94, JT. Quite an interesting one, considering what went on. So do you remember him at the time, or is this something like you've had to come back and do a bit of research on?
Oh, no, I remember him, and it was mercifully short because he was way, way past his expiration date. And I mean, he would show back up in like WWF later as a manager, which was fine. But as an active wrestler in title contention, fall of 1994 is just way past, you know, where he should have been, like very moldy, very stale. And he was, of course, part of that Hulk Hogan group of misfits that all came in. I think Hogan had recommended him or whatever. And yeah, I vividly remember his run in WCW, and it was terrible. Just everything with the WCW, you know, that theme he had, which we'll get to, and just, I mean, he could still cut like decent promos, but those promos were stuck in like 1980s territory style. So it was nothing positive in my mind from that Honky Tonk run.
Yeah, I think the run wasn't positive whatsoever. The business had passed him by 1994. He was always a weak kind of chicken shit heel anyway. I just think it wasn't the right time for him. As I said, he actually was brought in. It was Jimmy Hart who got him his job. It was Jimmy Hart that was basically badgering Bischoff to bring Honky Tonk Man in, and Bischoff appeased him. And he was brought in on a day-to-day deal, wasn't he? He wasn't a contracted guy, so he was used, you know, as and when, which didn't really sit well with old Honky. But he'd been in when his debut actually for WCW was in August of 1994. Wasn't it? Yeah, he came on the TV and he beat Terry Taylor. So Terry Taylor, poor Terry Taylor, 1994, jobs to Honky Tonk Man at Worldwide Tapings at Disney in 2:32. So obviously there was a bit of a push going on for Honky Tonk Man, which is interesting if he's used on a day-to-day deal, really. What are your kind of thoughts on bringing someone in on a deal like that? Do you think that's going to get their back up because they're looking for a longer contracted deal?
Yeah, maybe the thought is, you know, he'll work hard and focus. He seems like a guy that probably has a bit of a rep of maybe being a little bit lazy. So if you pay him some guaranteed money, you know, does he balk? He has a history of, you know, refusing to drop titles. Or did Bischoff just do it to shut Jimmy Hart up and just figure it, all right, day to day, and then I can just cut him when I want to cut him. Now on the flip side, is he worth the day-to-day deal to have to hear Honky probably bitch nonstop about it, because he definitely seems like the type of guy that would not shut up about it. Also possible, poor Terry Taylor, yeah, just everything fell apart after that Red Rooster run for him. But I mean, I guess that's the best you could say, is just that they don't want to commit to this guy. He had a history of kind of being a little bit flaky, kind of being demanding, and they probably just wanted an easy out where they're not stuck paying him if they decide not to use him anymore. I'm guessing Bischoff saw the writing on the wall with Honky Tonk Man, right? He probably saw that this guy's kind of cooked, kind of baked. Do we, you know, really want to commit to him long term? Let's do this as a, you know, we'll help out Jimmy Hart as a friend, and that's all.
Yeah, I think the reason, the motivation for helping Jimmy Hart out was just, it all boils back to Hogan, because you keep Jimmy Hart happy.
Right.
And Jimmy Hart's not moaning. He's not in Hogan's ear when a contract renewal's up saying, look, this isn't working. Let's go back to WWF, or let's go to New Japan. Let's do whatever. So I think it's important to keep someone like Jimmy Hart happy at this point in time. But yeah, I mean, Honky Tonk Man, he's on TV. He's beating Brad Armstrong, Larry Santo, Frankie Lancaster, Jim Steele, Brad Armstrong again. And then he's beating on the house shows. He's beating Brian Pillman, which... It's ludicrous. In 1994, Honky Tonk Man on house shows is beating Brian Pillman, and these are that just shows WCW's mentality at the time. They're going for the names, even though someone like Brian Pillman had been in the company, had been in WCW for over 5 years at this point. He's former tag team champion, former light heavyweight champion, and he's jumping to Honky Tonk Man on house shows. And then Honky Tonk Man, he does have this feud with Johnny B. Badd. Yeah, they have the Halloween Havoc match that went to a 10-minute time limit draw, which is for the TV title.
Which is ridiculous that you have fucking Honky Tonk Man in 1994 taking Johnny B. Badd to the time limit in a title feud. I mean, again, like, his promo stuff is okay. He cut, like, a decent one with Gene where he's talking about the match. And, like, yeah, I know Honky's always been about that, kind of getting that mid-card title, but just it feels so... Yeah, I don't know. We've seen Johnny B. Badd doing so much over the last couple of years, really building up his rep as a worker, improving in the ring, and then just has to go out there and fight even with fucking Honky and his stupid singlet tights and the overweight. Just, you know, this is like terrible with his soft friggin' offense like that. It looks like it hurts nobody. Couldn't even break an egg. And Johnny B. Badd's out there, has to go even with him and, I mean, you know, put him over in parts of the feud. Honky's attacking him on TV. Just everything just felt real awful. But with a guy that they were really trying to establish in Johnny B. Badd, having him go to draws with Honky. And I know the draws were a crutch for the TV title, and it happened with a lot of guys. But I don't know. This one just felt off. Like, it just felt very counterproductive to getting Badd over.
Oh, yeah. I think the reason for the one was to keep the feud going. So we went on and we had on Clash of the Champions 29, Johnny B. Badd beat Honky Tonk Man, but this time via DQ in 6-10. So there we go. That can still keep the feud going. It wasn't a decisive win for Johnny B. Badd. So that was what led us up to the Starrcade match. So the whole thing was Honky Tonk Man, as we mentioned, was on a day-to-day deal. He wasn't happy about this, so he tries to have a bit of a power play and tries to hold up Bischoff, because he does this on the day of the pay-per-view. Bischoff obviously doesn't see that much value in Honky, and he's got a reason now to fire his ass. So he fires his ass, and then out comes Arn Anderson. And that's really the kind of story of it. Lesson learned, don't fuck with Bischoff. Really, on this occasion, someone like Honky Tonk Man obviously thought he had more power than he did, and Bischoff has gone on record and said it was the most satisfying firing he's ever had to do, which is quite interesting. Obviously, Honky Tonk Man does rub up people the wrong way. Even to this day, he's very vocal online, isn't he? Not online as such, more into like the shoot interview side of things.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, he definitely is a guy that I don't think had many fans, and I'm sure Bischoff couldn't wait to fire him from the minute he hired him. And Honky gave him just, you know, the reason to do so. And like we said, I mean, he's just a guy that refused to do jobs, a guy that refused to, you know, do business sometimes. And here, to refuse to lose to Johnny B. Badd in the, you know, arguably the biggest show of the year is absurd. Like, did he really think he should be protected? I mean, he's lucky he has a job. He's lucky he's getting paid in a national promotion in 1994 at this point. And I know, you know, partially with a lot of these guys, and we see it to this day, they want to protect their gimmicks so they can go out and do conventions and independent territory, you know, at the time territory stuff. But I mean, a loss to Johnny B. Badd is not going to hurt Honky Tonk Man's independent drawing power. And I was watching one of the matches on the playlist. I think it was one of his first ones where Honky comes out, and there's this friggin' woman in the crowd that has these huge tits, and Tony loses focus completely as she's dancing to Honky Tonk's theme. And then there's an old toothless man playing his crutch as a guitar, and Bobby says, "Oh, that's the guy from Deliverance." So that stuff made me laugh. But the theme song, Honky's theme song, is atrocious. We talked about a couple weeks ago Hulk Hogan's WCW theme, how it was like a knockoff of his WWF one, and how poorly written it was. This one's just as bad. I mean, this is like a straight ripoff of Cool, Cocky, and Bad. It's just like the same beat, just slightly rearranged words, and you could tell like him and Jimmy Hart probably put it together, and it's just, the whole thing feels so outdated. I mean, it's like they pulled them out of 87 and just dropped them here into this feud of Johnny B. Bad.
Yeah, I think I heard the theme as well, yeah, and it's a straight ripoff, complete ripoff, wasn't good at all. But that sums up WCW. They were just kind of rehashing things that had been successful, you know, 7-8 years earlier. But you can see Honky Tonk Man's point, really. Like you said, he didn't want to lose when he didn't have any guarantees, because it would hurt him anyway. He would feel he came from that old school mentality, and he had a point that someone like Brad Armstrong hadn't been working, they wouldn't be used for 6 months a year at a time, and his contract would automatically roll over, whereas Honky Tonk Man was stuck on this kind of day-to-day deal. So he wasn't happy about that, but that shows that the difference between what Bischoff thinks of someone like a Brad Armstrong versus a Honky Tonk Man, really.
Well, he probably saw Brad Armstrong as just a valuable hand. And, I mean, if you look at guys in that level, Honky Tonk Man's not going to make you any fucking money in 1994, 1995. So, in his mind, he's like, all right, well, who's less likely to give me trouble, give me headaches? Brad Armstrong. He'll go out there, he'll put on a good match, he'll do his job, and he'll put over whoever I want him to put over. Like, to me, that guy has more value than Honky Tonk Man, who's going to bitch and moan, not want to lose, give me nonsense, and probably make the same amount of, draw the same amount of money as Brad Armstrong at this point. I mean, you know, do I get the value of a Honky Tonk Man in 1987, 88 as a heat machine, cowardly heel that kept his title for a year and then paid all of it back? Yes. 1994, 95, even with the Hogan influx of the retreads, I just don't see it. Like, do you see any potential for Honky Tonk Man to be any kind of serious player or money-drawing potential in WCW at this time?
No, because let's move on to 1995. He would be all over a show like Uncensored if he was still working. And that show was bad enough as it was. But seeing Honky Tonk Man in some Uncensored match against Johnny B. Badd, what it would have probably been is another Johnny B. Badd match. Because if you remember, Johnny B. Badd at Uncensored 95, he had that boxing match with Arn Anderson, which was the shits. So I bet Honky Tonk Man may have had that spot, considering that Arn took over the Starrcade spot from him, which is interesting, really. So, yeah, I think Honky Tonk Man, he was never once pinned or submitted on TV during that entire run from August up to December, which is crazy. So he did well out of it, really. So he went on to the Indies, and he was, you know, back in the limelight to a degree. So he may have got, you know, more fees on his bookings.
Yeah, it's definitely possible. And then, of course, like we said, I mean, he does go back to WWF in, I think it's like, what, late 96?
Yeah.
And he's there pretty much almost all through most of 97. So I don't know if this run helped him get that run again. I'm not sure. But yeah, he's a guy that still makes his money to this day with that gimmick, whether it's conventions or indie shows. So whatever. I mean, you know, I don't question the validity of him. I just, you know, I agree 100% with WCW to say, A, we didn't need you, and B, fuck you for not wanting to put over one of our... I thought at this point Johnny Badd was kind of one of their young up-and-coming stars that had potential to really be a player for them, and he is not a guy that should be... You know, if you want to feud him with Honky, that's fine, but he should be killing Honky when they have their match finally, not going to a draw and then have Honky balk at putting him over. I think at this point Honky's on fumes in the ring as far as a national promotion goes.
Oh, yeah, so that was the last of Honky Tonk Man, you know, on an in-ring capacity, you know, in a program with anyone, because he had some shots. I think he did some Rumble stuff, didn't he? He was one of the legends. He'd been used a few times since, but yeah that was the last
maybe,
kind of run.
Something like that. Yeah, so yeah, he's always popped back up here and there. He's not in the Hall of Fame, though. I think he's holding out probably for a bigger payday or something like that. Or he doesn't want to sign over his rights, I think is what it is, right? Because when you sign the Legends deal, the WWE kind of takes over a lot of your likeness rights and whatnot. So he probably, I don't think he wants to give that up because he probably makes more. Obviously, still cleans up on the convention circuit.
And he's got a fine head of hair still. Yes. I don't know if he's got a wig or not, but he's doing okay in the hair department.
Yeah, it's held on. It's held on for sure. But yeah, I mean, it's funny because it's in the small scope of things, it's a pretty forgettable run, just a few months. But for whatever reason, I think it's stuck with a lot of people because of how out of place he seems when you watch that show, even with the Hogan influx. Because when Honky came in, I don't think we had gotten the full Hogan boat yet. Like, you know, Beefcake was there, but he's kind of Hogan's buddy. He's not really doing anything. We hadn't gotten Tenta yet. We hadn't gotten Piper yet. You know, like, a lot of these guys hadn't popped up yet. I guess maybe Duggan, was he the only one? Like, I feel like it was just the two of them so far that had really showed up. So it wasn't like we had already had this, you know, big influx of guys yet. So Honky was kind of on the cutting edge of that group. So it just felt, it just felt off.
Anybody specifically in mind here when you take a look at the great champion?
Oh, is anybody in mind, Mean Gene? I look down that list and I see the Honky Tonk Man is going to have to score some hits in the WCW. I see people like Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Hulk Hogan, and Johnny B. Badd. You see the Honky Tonk Man. I don't like impersonators. I don't like cheap imitators because I'm an original.
Yeah, well, we'll move on from Honky now into the second question. So we've got Dear Alan and JT. My favorite wrestler is The Gambler. He was a major influence on me growing up, so much so that he got me interested in gambling when I was still in kindergarten. Did he ever win a match? And that's from Scott Campbell in Ely, Georgia.
Oh, so, Scotty Campbell, the gambling fool.
Yeah, I mean, look at that. Gambler, getting him hooked on gambling in kindergarten. Imagine that. He's playing some Texas Hold'em on the, you know, during recess.
It is the backwoods of rural Georgia, so it does not surprise me that they're gambling at age 10 or whatever.
So The Gambler, he's a bit of a cult hero, isn't he, really? He's a lot of people, including mine, one of my favorite WCW jobbers, because he actually had a gimmick where he came out with a pack of cards and he was jawjacking in the microphone, and you know, that was his gimmick, really. Did he throw the cards at you ever? I don't know, I can't remember, but yeah, he just had a deck of cards with him, really, and that
I think
was
he
it.
Threw he was, them he, yeah I think he threw them sometimes, and you're right, he did have he was doing a lot of jawjacking. I thought he had good facial expressions, good movements. He kind of slithered around and you know, overacting in that good 90s jobber way, like very pronounced mannerisms all over the place. And he always looked to me like a hobo, like a guy that was like, you know, just going from town to town on a train with his deck of cards and just would saunter up to the arena. That's what he always felt like. And I also thought he looked like Uncle Rico from Napoleon Dynamite, a very striking resemblance there. But that's my impression too, is that he had a lot of personality for just kind of a throwaway jobber. I think he was like the answer to WWF's like Mike Sharp and those guys that were a level above the no-name jobbers, because they kind of had a little bit of a personality about them. Brooklyn Brawler, guys like that.
Yeah, no, I was a fan of him. And he first made his appearance on WCW TV in 1990, in late 1990, as Jeff Gamble. So he wasn't The Gambler yet. So he went and did some shows, you know, sporadic shows in 91 and 92. Nothing really to write home about, obviously jobbing on them all. And in 1993, he dropped the Jeff name and took on an alias that would, you know, take over the world, over the next few years. And if he won things and non-won things, he actually won a title, JT. I didn't realize this in USWA. He went in, and it was April the 15th, 95. He teamed with Brickhouse Brown, and they defeated all 297 pounds of PG-13 to claim the tag team titles in USWA. So after a dry, barren spell of years without winning, he won a title in USWA. And this was at a time when USWA were open to using WCW guys sometimes, and they had this agreement with the WWF. So it was quite a unique thing. Obviously, The Gambler wasn't really a high name, and it didn't really even register in places like Pro Wrestling Illustrated.
Was he even contracted, or was he like, because, you know, a lot of jobbers at the time would just get paid by appearance. So I'm curious if he was actually under contract, or if he was just kind of could do what he wanted, because he was basically a freelance guy that would use for TV tapings.
Yeah, he was a freelance guy that they used for TV tapings, but he was still doing stuff in 95. I mean, his 95 stuff was at the back end, really. So he was getting beaten by Lex Luger, Johnny B. Badd, Jerry Lynn's Mr. JL. He appeared on Nitro, got beat by Dave Sullivan. He was a mainstay of a Saturday night WCW pro type of guy. And obviously, he'd been around for years. He's 93 was really when he started working more and more, and then he went all the way up to 99, so he was a good hand, really. I do actually think, though, he didn't do too badly for himself, because I found how much money he earned during, you know, some of the run that he had in WCW, and for a guy that was only used on TV tapings, really, and the odd, you know, that I can see, one Nitro, he was getting paid $32,000 in 96, $31,000 in 97, $32,000 in 98, and in 99, $22,000. So in total, for those 4 years, he earned himself a nice $118,000. And obviously, he would have had some other work.
So I would that's hope a good so. Little... yeah, because if not, he's hurting overall. But yeah, I mean, if this is his like side gig that he just did on weekends or whatever, yeah, that's not a bad little side hobby. And maybe he was gambling on the side, and that's where he made the rest of his money. You know, maybe he was doing the poker tournaments or... strubbing around Atlantic City, trying to, you know, clean up on the roulette tables. Maybe that was his main source of income.
Yeah, I think the gambler, he actually, he lasted till 99, and that's when, unfortunately, he folded on the world of wrestling, and he was out of his WCW. But his main WCW moment, as you'd say, there was nothing apart from jobbing, but he did actually have the debut match with Glacier. You know, the months and months of the Blood Run Cold gimmick that was all over TV in 96 to build Glacier up. And his debut was actually on WCW Pro, not on Nitro, where the gambler did the honours for him. So he was trusted enough to, you know, do that with him. So, yeah, the gambler, to me, he reminded me of a shit Arn Anderson in his look. You know, he had the kind of silk jacket like Arn had, a black one. He was going bald like Arn. He had some stubbly facial hair like Arn. He wasn't the worker that Arn was, but he was always fun. The gambler to me was, you know, great fun as a wrestler. As we touched on at the start, he had a gimmick. There was something that made him more memorable than other guys that you would see show up like a Frankie Lancaster for years on TV. So I've got nothing but positive memories from for the gambler, but I'm not sure what he's up to now, JT. And the only kind of thing I can find is his real name was Jeff Gann. That's it. But he's not really much information about him online. I had to do a bit of digging for this. But his final match that he had in WCW, he got beaten by a guy called Johnny Attitude on WCW Worldwide in 99. So I'm not actually sure who Johnny Attitude was, really. That's just kind of cropped up there. But he was getting beaten around in 99 by the Disciple and Eric Watts and you know, Lodi and people like that, Vincent.
1999, so Eric Watts, by the way. We'll talk about him, I guess, at some point. But
oh, yeah.
I watched his match. It's on the playlist if you guys want to check it out, where he fights the gambler. And it is. I mean, the gambler looks better than Eric Watts in that match. Watts looks terrible. His finisher in that match is just watch that match on the playlist. Just for his finisher, I don't even know what it was. And the announcer struggled to even like explain what it possibly could be. It's so bad. He just like grabs his head and falls to the mat, and he kind of lands awkwardly on his side. It's very weird. Watts was not good in 1999. Watts was certainly not good. But yeah, there's a bunch of gambler matches on the playlist. So if you're in a gambling mood, check those out. But yeah, I don't know what he's up to now, Alan. Maybe he's doing some of the poker tours or something like that. Maybe he's cleaning up online poker.
We would hope so. The thing I've just noticed as well with the research that I found, you know, I mentioned what he got paid each year. In 1997, he only worked 3 times and he got paid $31,000. Wow. In 1998, right? He worked 2 times and he got paid $32,000, I think. Yeah, that's right. And then in 99, he worked 9 times and got paid $22,000. So when he worked the most, he got paid the least. That's just classic WCW for you. But that makes me think that he was under some sort of contract.
It has to be, because if he's getting much. Unless he's just appearing, unless it's like, you know, they're paying him to come and they just didn't use him or something like that. I mean, that's possible too. So it was like a pay by appearance, but, you know, he would come to the arena and just not get used. So he'd get paid anyway, maybe. Or, I don't know, maybe he was under a contract. Maybe they had those guys locked in at that point. I mean, that was the big years where they were, you know, blowing all their money, so.
I think there's a match that stood out to me here. I think it's a bit of a hodgepodge in 96. We had the Dungeon of Doom, Hugh Morris, Kevin Sullivan, Meng and the Barbarian beat, Butch Long, Chad Brook, Prince Iaukea and the Gambler on WCW Saturday Night. So that's a nice mixture of people there. If I've ever seen an 8-man tag on WCW Saturday Night, so that's something that if I can find, I will actually add to the playlist. But yeah, there's plenty of footage to go through. If you can watch as well, there's an Eddie Guerrero gambler match that's out there from Saturday Night in 1995. It's all sorts of fun. Obviously, anything involving Eddie's always you know, worth watching. But yeah, good hand was the gambler. I'm happy to kind of talk about him on a show like this, because I don't think there's, you know, the gambler really has been spoken about, even as much as, you know, the 10 minutes we've given him now at all. So if you're a gambler fan and you know all the friends that are, you know, gambler fans from years ago, tell them about this segment, tell them about this show. We'd much appreciate it.
Agreed. Spread the word, and well, may he can come join us and teach us his ways of gambling.
Well, I'd love to find him. You know, that might be something we can do. That would be a coup for us, finding getting a gambler on the show. Definitely. He sums up the show. So thank you very much for all your service to Wrestling There, the Gambler. So shall we now do what we do every week, and shall I hop on into my car?
Yes, Alan. Why don't you dive into that front seat of your car and hit us up with the 1-800-COLLECT-ROAD-REPORT, looking back at this day in WCW history.
The United Center, but tomorrow night we're going to be at the Wisconsin Center in Milwaukee. We've already sent our good friend Lee Marshall there, and he reports in from Milwaukee on the road with 1-800-COLLECT. Lee, are you cold?
Tony, I am cold, but the only thing keeping me warm here is the cheeseheads. I mean, the fans here haven't been this excited since the Bucks won the coin toss and got Lou Alcindor as their first pick.
Well, this day in WCW history, as we record, is the 17th of May, and on this day in 1992, with the absolutely excellent WrestleWar 92 show, which I loved. I didn't watch live, obviously, being from the UK. We didn't have access to the WCW pay-per-views. I got it on Turner Home Video whenever it was out. Probably we had a slow turnaround here, I think, so it may have been 93 I would have seen this show. But there was two matches that really stood out to me, JT, on this show, and the first one was the Steiner Brothers defeated Tatsumi Fujinami and Takayuki Iizuka, which was a hell of a match. Do you remember this match, JT?
I do. I remember the show pretty well. And that match is still, I mean, those guys beat the shit out of each other. And I watched a clip on the playlist today with the where Steiner's doing like this front roll Death Valley Driver kind of move, and he lands square on his head. And it looked like his neck was broken, but he pops right up and just does it again to the other guy. He was fucking out of his mind at that point. But yeah, that was a war. Those guys beat the shit out of each other.
Yeah, it was. I don't think it was Fujinami got much of an abuse. It was Rick and Scott just destroying Iizuka. Yes. Do you think some of that's for any reason, Boy was a young boy and he was just doing that, or there may have been something that happened.
Because they would always do that to jobbers and stuff. So yeah, maybe just this is a guy in their mind that hadn't earned the respect in their eyes yet. So they're just gonna beat the shit out of him. I mean, if you watch like especially their WWF squashes, like they would just murder jobbers. So I think if you're an unknown guy, they'd just take it out on you. So yeah, again, maybe just a young guy hadn't earned their respect yet, and they beat the piss out of him.
Yeah, and I think hats off to him, like we said, that he hung on in the match and, you know, finished till the end. It was a really good match, really stiff, but slightly uncomfortable because it looked like Rick, you know, out the two was enjoying himself, you know, giving Iizuka head drops and strikes and, you know, some quite brutal mat work as well. So it's definitely something you can check out on the playlist and some clips of it, and you can watch the full match on the WWE Network. But the main event was such a memorable match for me, which was Sting Squadron, which was Sting, Barry Windham, Dustin Rhodes, Ricky Steamboat, and Nikita Koloff, and they beat the Dangerous Alliance of Steve Austin, Rick Rude, Arn Anderson, Bobby Eaton, and Larry Zbyszko in a War Games match. And it was a 5-star match. Meltzer went the full 5 stars on it, and it was the second straight year that WrestleWar main event got 5 stars. And this match, fantastic. Would you go the full 5 stars on it?
Yes. I mean, there are some, and I want to say to this point, I think Chad and Parv maybe even on Where the Big Boys Play, like, is this considered the greatest WCW match in history? I mean, it's definitely in the very, very high-ranking consideration, right? I mean, I'm not going to speak to, like, the Crockett era is kind of different. Like, you have Tully and Magnum and some of the stuff, but, I mean, the proper WCW era from late 88 through the end, I mean, this is on the short list of potential best matches in promotion history, right?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely, for me, it's probably this. The 91 one's fantastic, but I think Sid doing some obvious spot calling took me out of the match a bit in that one. And there's also the infamous Eddie Ray Halloween Havoc 97, you know, 5-star, you know, brilliant match as well. I think those three would, off the top of my head, are three that stand out to me as, you know, fantastic top-end WCW matches. And this one was fantastic. It was such a great sense of chaos and violence all the way through the match. And there was different rivalries through there. We had Wyndham seeking revenge for kind of earlier on in 91 having his arm broken. We had Dustin, who was the fiery young kind of up-and-comer. We had Medusa involved with it as well. We had Paulie, who was great on the outside throughout this, kind of freaking out and then being happy. We had kind of good blade jobs in there. We had Austin bumping like, you know, nobody's mm-hmm. business. And we had Arn Anderson, you know, that spot where he had his head driven between the two rings was fantastic as well. So I love this match. It's, you know, really, really good. And if you've not seen this match, you should really go out your way to see it, guys, because it is, you know, that five-star match. It's fantastic. And I think, for me, the one thing that stood out to me when I watched this for the first time, this would have been 93, I wouldn't have seen much Larry Zbyszko before this. Mm-hmm. I wasn't aware of his AWA run, you know, that came on the next few years later when I kind of dived deeper into the history of wrestling. But to me, he stood out as like a weaker kind of guy, you know, in his team with Austin Rude on and Eaton. He was like the weak link of it. And that kind of showed he submitted at the end of the match. And that was his end in the Dangerous Alliance, wasn't it?
It was. And the cool thing about this, too, is not only it's a great match, but the build is awesome. Like the payoff to the build is great. It's got all the star power you could want for 1992 WCW. A lot of big names, a lot of great workers, and everything had built so organically to this point. And the Dangerous Alliance lasts longer than I had remembered. Like when I rewatched this stuff a couple years ago, I had forgotten how long the Alliance actually lingered on. I always thought that this was the end. It's not the same. Like the proper Dangerous Alliance is from the end of 91 to here. It kind of splinters after this, with even Rude kind of splitting off a bit and going with Medusa. But it's an awesome, awesome run. And the match is the perfect payoff with the, you know, with them falling apart at the end because of the accidental hit with the, they break apart the turnbuckle crank and smash Larry in the arm with it. And it was good payback too, because, you know, Larry had built up his cruncher name with having slammed Wyndham's hand on the door. So then they kind of paid off with Zbyszko getting his arm cracked with this thing. It's one of the first real WCW matches I remember seeking out. Like, I had started watching probably late 91, and I remember being really hyped for this one and somehow getting a tape of it. I don't even know how, but I remember being able to watch it pretty soon after it aired and just like being obsessed with the match. Like, I really loved it. I think it's definitely up there, if not the best, at least in the top three of all time WCW matches. Classic.
Would War Games work nowadays?
I mean, like anything, I think it just comes down to the story behind it. Yeah, like I think they have such great wrestlers in WWE these days that could make this match work for sure if you have the right story to build to it. Now, if you make a yearly War Games pay-per-view like they did with Elimination Chamber and Hell in a Cell, where whatever feud happens to be going on that month gets stuck in there, nah, it's not as enticing. If you're going to tell me we have a long burn, you know, feud that pays off organically in a War Games, absolutely. Like, if they did a SmackDown versus Raw, you know, battle that led to a War Games match between their top five on each side, it's built around a pay-per-view just for that, yes, absolutely, it could work.
But saying that, though, just out of interest, I mean, the WCW and NWA War Games were always around the same time each year. You know, we had the 91 and 92 War Games pay-per-views with This Is the Main Event, and we had the Great American Bash shows.
It was. And Fall Brawl, yeah, I guess Fall Brawl always had it too, even when you look at those last few years, right? It was always War Games. So, yeah, I mean, maybe. But they always found a way to make it organic, didn't they? Like,
That's right, yeah.
None of those ever felt forced. I mean, you could say maybe the Hogan Dungeon of Doom, but even that kind of built naturally to that point. I don't feel like they ever had one that felt like, oh, okay, it's War Games time. Let's put these guys in there. It always felt like if the feud had earned War Games status. And it doesn't feel that way with, like, Elimination Chamber or Hell in a Cell and some of the stuff. Like, doesn't always feel like the feud, you know, required that match.
Yeah, it's not like WWE who do Hell in a Cell just for the sake of it matches, and they always the matches now that randomly start a feud. We start a feud with Hell in a Cell, and the final match in the feud will be a straight singles match, which is completely backward-ass booking, but that's how they do it, because they have to fit the pay-per-views, and it's not natural, it's not organic, and I'm not a fan of it like you. But yeah, this 1992 WrestleMania 92 show, top to bottom, it's a really fun show, but those two matches, definitely, I'd recommend anyone who's not seen them to check them out. Anyone who's not seen them in a few years, go back and watch them, enjoy them. WCW was great. It did have good matches, and these are prime examples of that. So shall we go on to the long form question, which is quite an interesting question, JT.
Yeah, I'm ready for it.
Okay. Dear Alan and JT, would love a feature on the power plant. Who came out of it in the pre-Goldberg Natural Born Thrillers era? Info about developmental shows around Atlanta, anything you can find out. And that's from Adam in New Jersey. So the power plant, JT, it's got a bit of a reputation. I would say that it didn't produce talent. But when we go through this question, I think it, you know, had a better than average kind of turnaround, you know, mm-hmm. for guys that went on and were successful in wrestling business for years to come.
I agree. And you know what? What makes it even more impressive is Life Magazine calls it the Harvard of professional wrestling. That that commercial is on the playlist, and it's one of my favorites. Like, when I think of the Nitro and Thunder era, I always think of that ad playing, the Harvard of professional wrestling, like, where they're promoting it. So, but yes, it actually was kind of ended up being in a decent list here, if you want to go through it.
Yeah, I mean, we'll just go through some other bits and bobs about it as well. I mean, it opened in early 1995. We had kind of Jody Hamilton was involved in it. It was one of the assassins, and it was Paul Orndorff began managing the power plant in 98. So he was the major guy in 98. But before that, the man that's got the most reputation of being involved with the power plant was Sergeant Buddy Lee Parker, who'd been around for years and years, anti state patrol. My favourite Sergeant Buddy Lee Parker moment, I don't know if I mentioned it on the show before, is when he's getting the hell beat him out of him with a mop or a cane by Abdullah the Butcher at Starrcade 91. That was a fun time. But he had a bit of a rep about him, didn't he, JT? He was a kind of a precursor to a Hugh Morris, a Bill DeMott kind of badass in, you know, beast in the guys, you know, who'd come through the power plant.
Yeah, he was a real prick, I thought. A real bully. DeMott Jr., which is funny because he's somehow, you know, if you notice the trend with these guys is their height. Like, this guy's kind of short, and he takes it out. And I thought, I was watching some of the pieces that are on the playlist. One is the, you know, they have all the different, I guess we'll talk about the fluff pieces, but in one of them, he's just like really, really just being a dick and you know, tearing down the guy that's trying out and just, yeah, I mean, probably a guy that was a good hand, knew how to work, you know, probably a good trainer, but just over the top and just being an asshole. Yeah, whatever.
I've just remembered my second favorite Buddy Lee Parker moment, and that's when, I don't know if you've seen this, and I've put this out there a few times now because it entertains the hell out of me, is when Virgil on WCW, one of the B shows, I don't know whether it was Saturday Night or Pro, he just drops him on his head on the apron suplex.
That was nasty.
And then it's like he slips. He didn't mean to do it, but the way Virgil just walks off in the way that, yeah, I did this, I'm a badass, yeah. It was hilarious, and it couldn't have happened to some, well, I don't wish anything bad really on anyone. That's taking it a bit far, but, you know, if it's going to happen to someone with karma, it's going to be right. Someone like Buddy Lee Parker. But it looked like it was a horrible, horrible thing to kind of take. But yeah, that's an entertaining gift. I'll dig that out and I'll post that when the show drops on Friday. Definitely one to entertain us. But yeah, the WCW power plant, they advertised, like we said, on WCW TV. It was all over Nitro. And I think they aired it, you know, on some of the syndicated shows as well. And the whole deal of it was once a month, there was open tryouts were held for applicants between the ages of 18 and 29. And if the applicants were suitably impressive, they would earn an invitation to join the school at a cost of $3,000 for 6 months of training. And male applicants had to be at least 5'9" inches tall and 180 pounds in weight.
So a foot taller than Buddy Lee Parker, then.
Yeah, which makes me, you know, makes me laugh. But, you know, just running down some of the trainees that they had at the power plant. Like I said, the director of the power plant was Jody Hamilton. We had the manager, it came in 98, was Paul Orndorff. Head trainer was, I love his name, Dwayne. It's a very American name, that, to me. Is that a popular name, you know, in the South in America, Dwayne?
I guess. I mean, I think of like a slack-jawed dope when I think of that name, Dwayne, you know. It's not one I really piece together with the... I don't know, like a high-ranking intelligent official. But I guess maybe the most famous, Dwayne Wayne from, it was a Cosby spinoff, a Different World. I'm trying to think if it was actually spelled Dwayne or Dwayne. I'll look that up. But yeah, I don't know if it's a popular name, Dwayne. Like, Dwayne would be, but I don't know if Dwayne is.
He's got two first names, Dwayne Bruce. There we go. Yeah.
Nowadays, it would be like D apostrophe Wayne, like Dwayne. Like, I think like that'd be more popular than Dwayne. But let's see, Dwayne Wayne, was he? No, I'm looking it up. No, that was regular Dwayne, so he's not even the most famous Dwayne.
There we go. So also we had Bobby Eaton. I'd have him any day of the week as a trainer, and I'm shocked he's never used at all, or not used, you know, full time, because he's not well. He's struggling a bit health wise. But surely, you know, the Performance Center could bring him in to do some talks on psychology or, you know, things of that nature. Obviously, he's not going to do promo classes or anything. But certain things that, you know, a Bobby Eaton could still bring to the table for, you know, in modern day wrestling, because he was such a good wrestler, really, really one of my favorites of all time. And, you know, he was involved in this, and, you know, it was only a good thing for the WCW guys who were, you know, training at the time. But a few guys here, and I'm not familiar with them. I don't know who Mike Hayner is. If you want to look him up, we've also got Lash LaRue. Harrison Norris, another guy I'm not sure of. Ray Lloyd, who was Glacier. We got Ron Reyes, was a trainer, who was a bit of an odd choice for trainer Ron Reyes. He was he Sick? No, not Sick Boy. Who was he in the flock?
He was Reese.
It was Reese. We went through that in the previous episode, didn't we? He was also the Yeti.
Mike Hayner, you will know him if you want to take a guess. I'll see if you can guess who it was. He was a WCW, pretty much an on-screen stalwart from 96 till the end. He had a couple different characters, was TV champion, and his name would not fit his gimmick name.
Van Hammer.
No, it was Prince Iukea.
Ah, oh, for that's the 96. I touched on him before. Oh, I didn't know that, Mike Hayner. There we go. You learn something every day. We had Mike Wenner and Pistol Pez Watley, and they were the male trainers. And then the female trainers that came on were Nora Greenwald, that was Molly Holly, and we had Deborah Michelli, who more famously known as Medusa. So they were the trainers that were involved with the power plant. So we had a mixed bag, but it wasn't kind of just as people would assume, you know, Jody Hamilton, Paul Orndorff, and Dwayne Bruce. We had other guys, you know, involved as well. So Ron Reyes obviously would be around to teach bigger guys how to bump and not sell or do whatever. I think that would be his role, I'd assume.
Yeah, I think so. I'm guessing that's why.
Yeah, but the graduates. So this is quite an interesting list of graduates. I mean, some of them I won't class them as graduates, but
attendees.
You know, guys that the attendees. These are guys that attended at some point. We had Brian Anderson, who was a guy we're going to hopefully touch on in future months. He was brought in '93. Was he? He was the guy that was. Am I getting mixed up now between him? Yeah, there's two. Was it two Andersons? There was the one. Was he brought in? He was the son of Ole Bryant. And then we have another. Do we have an Anderson that was from Sweden that did an amateur wrestling gimmick?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Oh,
yeah, I'm not sure.
I should know this. That's I'm shocking. We also had this. If you maybe look that up, we had C.W. Anderson that went
Bryant,
on.
Yeah, Bryant Anderson is the son of Ole. Yes.
Right. Right. And then there was the other Anderson that did an amateur gimmick in 93, but that was the guy that I was referencing anyway. We'll come back to him. We had C.W. Anderson that went for a bit of fame in ECW. We had Shark Boy, who's been going for years. I mean, he's been around in the indies now. I think he's Dean Rowley's name, and he's had that run in TNA. He was quite over. He was a cult guy. We had Sick Boy, Chad Brock, Johnny the Bull, the Cole Twins. Of course.
Oh, our
boys.
They always
seem to crop up every episode, don't they?
Yeah, they're like the mascots of Letters from Center Stage. We talk about that. You know, you had Virgil Letters from Kayfabe, but you had the Cole Twins here and Letters from Center Stage. They're official mascots.
We had the Demon. Big fan of the Demon doing the Kiss gimmick. And I don't know how much they paid a hell of a lot of money for that gimmick, didn't they, WCW?
Oh, God. Absurd amount. And then they had the concert. And if you remember, he had to have like X amount of main event matches in quotes. And so they had a match where he was like third from the top, and they called it like a special main event attraction match or whatever. It's just such a joke. Waste of money.
Yeah,
it was supposed to be Bryan Adams that they spent all the money for. And then it didn't end up being him, and they gave it to Dale Torborg. Son of MLB manager Jeff Torborg. But do you remember why it wasn't Adams? Like, what happened with that? Like, because he stays around. He does Chronic after that.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they didn't want to put a guy that's... I don't know, because he could have put that gimmick on anyone else. Like, I was thinking someone that's unstable, someone that's been fired in the past, someone... And that was for other things. I think he got involved in some heavy kind of gun crime and stuff in Hawaii in 95. That's when he came back as the kind of convict crush. But yeah, he was... I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Do you?
No, I wonder if he's the one that... I wonder if he balked at it. Maybe he realized how fucking terrible it was that he was like, I don't want any part of this. But no, I don't think they pulled him from it. But it was definitely designed for him... originally, so I don't know if he got hurt. I'll try and find out what happened there.
Okay.
But he definitely sticks around. Here we go. Afterwards, he was chosen to portray the Kiss-themed wrestler, the Demon, after walking out in the NWO and entering a limo that had the band inside. Played the character for its debut on August 23rd when Kiss played a concert, and played it one more time and had a stare-down with Vampiro. The Demon mantle was then passed to Dale Torborg with no explanation given, and Adams was switched back to his given name. So something happened that they didn't want him to be the gimmick anymore. I don't know if it was a you know, promise to Torborg or something, or if Adams just asked out of it, but he was only the Demon twice. So,
well, I'm just going to go through the rest of the names, and then we can just talk about them at the end. Anyone that stand out, we had Diamond Dallas Page, who's famously, you know, credited the Power Plant for, you know, his improvement in ring, and, you know, going on to, you know, a lot bigger, bit better things. David Flair, the Giant, Goldberg, Hardbody Harrison, Shane Helms. Here's a guy. I'm sorry, I was going to swear. Horseshoe. Have you? I mean, someone we'll have to come back to in a future episode. Are you aware of who Horseshoe is?
Yes,
or was, or the gimmick? Yeah. Yes. Oh yeah, we're gonna. I don't want to spoil that for people who don't. We're gonna come back to that one. We had Mark Jindrak, Chris Kanyon, Lash LaRue, Lodi, Steve McMichael, who'd obviously done some PowerPoint stuff to get him ready. Ernest Miller, Shannon Moore, Kevin Nash.
When would Nash have trained? Yeah, I mean, maybe he worked out there a little bit in between, like when he first, because there's that gap when he signs with WCW, so maybe he was there for a little bit, but I mean, it wouldn't have opened till 95. He was long gone by then as Diesel.
I think it may have been for some of these in this list. I mean, graduates is used loosely. He may have come in to use the ring to get used to the smaller ring of the ropes. Yeah, that probably was more likely. We had some more famous graduates, Sean O'Hare and Chuck Palumbo. We had The Renegade. We had Reno. We had Kid Romeo. Mike Sanders. Bob Sapp. that was interesting. Sonny Siaki, Elix Skipper, The Wall, Kwee Wee, Alex Wright, and Young Yang. So they were the male guys, and the female graduates were Asia, who was the lady who was bigger than China. That was the gimmick. We had Daphne, Major Guns, Stacey Keebler, who also was Natural Girl Sky, Miss Hancock, Adasia, who was one of Scott Steiner's freaky.
Yes.
Yeah, freaks, that was it. We had Paisley, who was Natural Girl Storm, Tit Tigress,
Charmel,
Natural.
Right? Paisley, Charmel, yeah. Booker's wife.
Yeah, Tigress and Tori Wilson. And just getting back to some of those Nitro girls, I tweeted on Friday, and I may retweet these while the show drops, what they're all up to now. Every single Nitro girl that was, you know, in WCW, picture of them then, picture of them now, and what they're doing now. And, you know, there's some that, you know, time hasn't been kind to, others that time has been, you know, very kind to. It was quite neat kind of going through that and finding that information.
Who's your favorite at the time?
Stacey Keebler. Stacey Keebler.
Spice was my girl.
Was Spice the short-haired one?
Yes, I was a big fan of Spice, and I actually ended up meeting her. Her and Bret Hart came to the mall here before a Nitro to sell tickets, and I got to meet her, so it was a highlight.
Wow. Spice is someone, actually, I tweeted about her. She was the most popular out of everybody as well, so she's definitely had an appeal to, you know, a lot of guys around that time, which is interesting. So we had the WCW PowerPoint, so that's all the kind of the graduates of it. Getting through to some of the footage, did you manage to watch the footage with the British guy that did the documentary, the WCW stuff, Louis Theroux? Did you manage to watch that? Yeah.
So I watched, so on the playlist, which I recommend, I've mentioned it a few times here tonight because it's loaded this week, there are like 6 or 7 like puff pieces that were done on the PowerPoint. And yes, one was this British guy that went actually through the rigors, and that's the one where Buddy Lee was being like an asshole. So, I mean, I guess he could have been playing it up to really put the guy through the reps. But, I mean, that we had CNN, we had MSNBC, Joan London behind closed doors. You know, it was featured as part of that, the Unreal Story of Professional Wrestling, the one with Steve Allen. And there were a lot of puff pieces about the power plant. It was pretty impressive that they got that much coverage, and it was spanned the time. Like, there was one as early as 96 and then one like later towards 99. I thought one interesting stat was when they said there's an 85% dropout rate for the power plant. So, which I think makes sense. I mean, a lot of guys probably go once and then forget it and then never come back after getting ripped. But one thing that did make me laugh, I think it was in the MSNBC one. They're showing this guy Nico that's working out, and he's got this like big Norseman kind of look, and they show him sitting at Nitro or Thunder or something, and he's signing autographs, and the lady shows it to Bischoff, who they call the head of WCW marketing. They don't even say his name. She just goes, "I showed the tape to the head of WCW marketing to get his thoughts," and his Bischoff just fucking rips the guy. He's like, "If I put this guy out there in a match tonight, he would, you know, get booed out of the arena. He's not ready, blah blah blah." But I just thought it was funny that they don't even acknowledge his name, and it's just like some random guy.
Just some suit.
But I recommend the puff, like, they're all pretty quick pieces. They're like all 5 to 7 minutes or so, but it's interesting to see the level of coverage. Like, do you remember them getting this much coverage for the power plant at this time?
No, I mean, the Louis Theroux thing, it was a big kind of documentary series that is, I like Louis Theroux. He's quite interesting. He did some stuff also in America. He's been around and went and stayed at some neo-Nazis' houses and interviewed them. And it's done in a way that he's poking fun at them, but they don't realize it because it's ludicrous. And he's quite a good, he plays a naive guy quite well in these kind of shows. So the Louis Theroux one's my favorite. And that was aired on TV here, I would have said, in about 99 here in the UK. And being a wrestling fan, you know, that being on BBC Two, which would probably be the third biggest station, you know, network station, population here in the UK, you may have got people like 5-6 million people watching these documentaries. So he had, you know, plenty of people watching them, and that stood out to me because Louis Theroux, after that, he went and met Raven and hung out with him and Alex Wright when he was doing the Berlin gimmick. He kind of filmed some of that, and it's quite an interesting kind of thing. And that's online if anyone wants to check out the full documentary that he did. It's if you just Google Louis Theroux WCW, you'll be able to find that. But yeah, the power plant itself, it was in three different locations throughout its history, but the most famous one was located at 1530 Carroll Drive in Atlanta. It stopped holding contests. You know, we mentioned that they had these open tryouts once a month. It stopped holding them in December 99. Maybe they knew the writing was on the wall, or there was not as much kind of investment in the power plant, I'm not sure. And the power plant itself closed in March 2001 when WCW's assets were sold to the WWF, which they took a lot of the rings and things like that. But the power plant itself, the building, is still involved in wrestling now. It's WWA4, which is Mr. Hughes's promotion, which is actually not a bad little promotion, to be fair, even though Mr. Hughes is involved. You wouldn't think he'd be a good trainer, but a lot of okay to good guys have come out of there. We've got, most famously, I think, AR Fox, a graduate of the Mr. Hughes promotion, but they tape some kind of dojo or trainee or academy shows that are live on YouTube from that venue. So it's quite interesting that that's still being used. But getting back to the original point about the WCW power plant, and was it successful, was it not? The names that really stand out is your DDPs, your Giants. They're the main two guys, you know, that came out of the power plant. And those two, if that was it, you know, we had the Giant, who's now obviously the Big Show, who's still going strong, you know, 22 years after his debut. DDP, that, you know, he'd been around in the business before, but he always says it was the power plant that was the reason that made him into the worker that he became.
And I think if you look at the power plant, and actually, you know, if you think of the way WCW is structured, and that was after 94, what was their goal? Their goal was to steal or take main event names, right, and use them to then headline their strong undercard. So, like a, you know, like a real well-off, like Major League Baseball or maybe like a soccer team, whatever, where you sign your high-level free agents to top off your really stocked, like, farm system. So, I mean, if you look at the names on here, they may not have become stars, but a lot of these guys filled the mid-card well in WCW, or the lower mid-card, and allowed them to then bring in the big names or bring in foreign guys to fill out the upper mid card. And then if you look at, like, a lot of this is like, was the guts of their TV for many years. Like, you know, even like a Lash LaRue and Ernest Miller, McMichael, Shannon Moore, O'Hare, Palumbo, like all these guys like filled out their cards. So I think it was successful. Like, there's not that many washouts on this list where guys that like didn't even make TV. Like, there's a few, but most of these guys had runs or sustained runs on WCW TV and helps fill out their shows.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, a lot of the graduates, to me, the back end when WCW was really going down the tubes, though, you know, your Kiwis and The Wall, Elix Skipper, guys like that, above average Mike Sanders, couldn't stand him. that was kind of the era of WCW when it got a little bit sad to watch it. Picked up again a little bit in 2000 WCW, but, you know, by that point, you know, they'd already done the damage, and, you know, they weren't getting the, you know, the support and the houses that they were getting in previous years. But yeah, the power plant, as I said, just to wrap it up, not as bad a venue as, you know, as a facility that people think. Obviously, we had the, you know, the rep with Sergeant Buddy Lee Parker being a badass kind of trainer guy. But it's quite interesting to kind of look back on now that it was the prototype kind of bully, kind of sergeant major type figure that, you know, that Bill DeMott became.
And speaking of Sanders, there's a couple of good ones too we watched today. One where the Natural Born Thrillers went back to the power plant, because remember, they had all come from there. That was their gimmick, almost like a proto Nexus for many years later. And they were working their way through. They go back to the power plant and beat up the trainees, and then they go to Paul Orndorff's office and beat the shit out of him as a group. I thought it was a really good segment they did on Thunder. I thought it was well done. Like, it was smart. Good idea to use that. Like, here are these guys that had come from there, that was their home, now they're trying to make names for themselves, and they go back and beat the shit out of everyone and lay waste to their training grounds. I thought that was well done. And then there's a funny one too, where Bobby Heenan and Scott Hudson take a road trip to the power plant during an episode of Worldwide. And it's interesting, because it's like very late era Bobby, where he's almost about done, And it felt very reminiscent of, like, classic Bobby when him and Gene on All-American would, like, go on these road trips and do random things. So, like, he has a big giant map and he's trying to find the power plant, and then he tries to work out and he's, like, botching the bench press, and Hudson's just there as the straight man. And it was kind of fun. It was like a cool little throwback to their old Bobby of the early 90s on these syndicated shows. So just a couple times they use the power plant, like, in storyline, not just as press.
Bobby.
What?
What is that?
A map
of what?
How to get to the power plant.
Well, you're 0 for so far, 0 for 2 weeks, trying to find this place. Bobby, you just go out that door right there, behind camera 2, hang a left at merchandising, and it's 20 feet right there.
Do I look stupid?
Yeah, it's just to wrap it up then. The interesting thing as well, compared to, say, WWE's facilities that they had that one at Trax, if you remember. Was it WWF Trax in, like, 2000, 2001?
Yeah, that was during, like, the Tough Enough era.
Yeah. And every time that they had some sort of training facility, even now, there was not a case of come and train, pay us, and we may bring you on as in a contracted wrestler. If not, you know, go away. Right. These were guys that everyone that WWF used were guys they thought that they would be able to train and use on TV, whereas WCW... Which is quite interesting. You may get a better success rate this way.
Yeah.
Yeah, more of a school, so more people coming through it, maybe.
Yeah, it was definitely more of a school where you would go sign up, like many other wrestling schools out there. You know, like WWF's was more of a minor league, farmhouse for them to build up their guys. Like, they go on scout and recruit guys and bring them in, and this is where they train them in their dojos. Versus WCW, that was more of, hey, you know, come out, it's open tryout season. Like, anyone can come in and pay, and then that's how they find their guy. So instead of actively scouting, which I'm sure they did here and there, it seemed like they were just like, all right, let's see who comes in off the street. Whereas WWF was, like, actively out there recruiting guys, trying to find talent, and then molding them in their own way in their school.
And I don't think $3,000 is too bad for 6 months training. You know, I'm presuming you can go whenever you want. The school's going to be open at least 5 days a week. And obviously,
maybe at the
you
time,
could go.
Because they, on the show where they say it, they kind of express, like, whoa, $3,000, it's a hefty sum. You know, so maybe, I guess in 1997 money, I guess maybe $3,000 for 6 months might have been a little, you know, kind of hefty.
But then that weeds out the people that really want to do it versus the ones that don't.
Definitely.
Because I wouldn't imagine this was a huge money spinner by any means. It would have brought in a nice chunk of change and kept some of the guys out of mischief like Paul Orndorff for a few years. But yeah, that's basically power plant. And just to touch on the question from Adam, I mean, something I want to come back to rather than answer it in this. There was some developmental shows around Atlanta, JT. Are you aware of this?
I was not.
Something I would like to come back to then. So if anyone wants to ask the question about that a bit in depth, and I'm sorry I'm not going to answer it now, Adam. Adam, what I'll do is we'll come back to that question, that bit of the question, on a future episode, because it is quite interesting that WCW did run these kind of really small shows in nightclubs and things in like 95, 96. It was something that I discovered listening to the Between the Sheets podcast when they covered, you know, that era. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty cool. So yeah, that hopefully answers most of the question there for you, Adam. So shall we get to just kind of the plugs now, wrap up the show, JT?
Yeah, which hour of which show of Between the Sheets was that in? Was that hour?
Yeah,
nine,
yeah,
of week? Okay. So why don't we go ahead and give the plugs. PlaceNation.com is where you can follow along with everything each and every day. On social media, we are at facebook.com/place2bnation, place2bnation on Twitter. And Alan, where can we find you on Twitter?
You can find me at Alan_Cheapshot. That's ALLAN_Cheapshot. You can send the questions to us on the show either via Twitter. It's sometimes easier, I'm going to be honest, because I do get quite a lot of mentions when on Twitter, and sometimes I miss out on what people ask
me.
There, so.
What a humble brag that was. He gets a lot of
on
Twitter.
I got a lot. There we go. But yeah, the best way to do it is lettersfromcenterstage@gmail.com. If you want to drop us a question that way, we can easily get to them there, and we'll happily go through them on future episodes for you guys. So I just want to thank everyone, as I said at the start of the show, for supporting the show. We're having a blast. We're 5 episodes in now, so we're a quarter of the way through the run that we had with Letters from Kayfabe. So do you think we've got the legs on us, JT, to kind of beat Letters from Kayfabe here?
I don't think we've even scratched the surface of the topics that we can cover. We have so much. I mean, I look at this list of names from the power plant. Each one of these guys could be an individual topic. You know what I mean? Like, we could do a show on Mongo. Like, we haven't even talked about him yet. And also, I just want to remind everyone to follow and subscribe to all of our iTunes feeds, too. Pro Wrestling Only, Place Elimination Wrestling, Place Elimination Pop. And leave us feedback, leave us ratings as well to help us get the shows seen by more people.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, thank you so much for supporting the show, guys. And like JT said, if you want to give us a rating and review on iTunes for the Place to Be Nation feed, it would really go a long way. We'd really appreciate that. So thank you very much for listening, guys. And we will be back again next Friday for another Letters from Centre Stage.
And I'm going to go hit the power plant and start getting some reps in.
Life magazine called it the Harvard of professional wrestling.
All right, the Honky Tonk Man is your winner.
One more time. Hey, there's the guy from Deliverance.
Ah! It's not hot!
Is it spread?
Yes.